Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, Associate Professor of Geography and Environmental Studies at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Flora Liu and Emily Murai, editors of Critical Campus Sustainabilities, Bridging Social Justice and the Environment in Higher Education, published in 2023 by Springer. Dr. Liu and Dr. Murai, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us. We're so excited to be here.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your backgrounds and how you came to write this book?
Great. So my name is Flora Liu, and I'm a professor of environmental studies at UC Santa Cruz, and I've been a faculty member there since 2003. And part of what excited me about this book is my research in the past has really been focused on the human-environment relationship more broadly. So I was trained as an Amazonianist. I've done a lot of work in the Ecuadorian Amazon in particular on political ecology and political economy in a context of oil. And as I have become more engaged with administrative work at the university, I've begun to focus more on the experience of our students as they move through the institution and think of themselves as environmental change agents. So in this regard, I became involved as a co-founder of something called the People of Color Sustainability Collective, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But what I just really wanted to emphasize today is that the People of Color Sustainability Collective, or POCSC for short, is really a student. It was really driven by student experiences and what they shared with faculty and staff in particular about what motivates them and what resonates with them within the environmental movement and the environmental field on campus. Because I think that we all want a more inclusive, diverse, and effective environmental movement, especially facing the conjoined crises that we are confronting as a society. So for me, the kind of the motivation behind this book is how can institutions, primarily higher education institutions, better prepare our young people and our students to meet this challenge?
And my name is Emily Murai. I am a lecturer at UC Santa Cruz. I am currently a lecturer in the Environmental Studies Department, but I was also a longtime lecturer in College 9, which is where I came to know Flora best, as she was provost of what is called College 9 and John R. Lewis College. I have a PhD in geography, so I'm very familiar with the literature on nature-society relations, but most of my career has really been focused on first-year composition, writing across the curriculum, writing in the disciplines, so very teaching-oriented. And right now I teach what's called the Disciplinary Communications course, a writing-intensive course in environmental studies, and I've taken on additional courses in the environmental humanities. And what really piqued my interest in this subject was having students come to me and feeling like they didn't belong in the department in environmental studies and really struggling to find their place because they were very interested in environmental issues, but not in the way that it's formulated in the department, which tends to be very science heavy, very STEM oriented. And they wanted to study other issues like questions of environmental justice and inequity and things like that. And so I came to this book thinking about how do we bring those students' perspectives into the department, into our courses, into the university, because I think that they have so much to offer, and yet they've been marginalized in some ways by the environmental movement, by their educational histories. And so how do we teach them and work with them in a way that allows them to be sort of agents and empowered by their education, as opposed to be feeling sort of marginalized and dispossessed by it?
Yeah, I think that's a really great thing to be aiming at. And I think you did a good job of it with this book. So, you know, the title is Critical Campus Sustainability. So what makes sustainability critical?
Yeah, great. So as Emily was talking about, the predominant approaches to sustainability oftentimes define this term. You know, we are familiar with the Brundtland Report, the three-legged stool of sustainability, and it tends to privilege techno-managerial and positivistic definitions, right? So, you know, what's our energy consumption in terms of water use, or like our waste flows and things like that. And these are all important considerations, don't get me wrong, but it tends to sidestep the sort of a political analysis and renders the sustainability issues largely devoid of the deeper social context in which sustainability is embedded. So in the introduction to the book, we address this particular question. So why critical sustainabilities? And so I'll take the second part first, which is that there is not one sustainability. So we very intentionally pluralize sustainabilities because we recognize that there are many, many ways of being sustainable in the world. And oftentimes what our students were experiencing, and this is especially true with our low-income students of color, was that sustainability concerns were manifest simply as consumer behavior. So if you were a low-income student and you couldn't buy, you know, the right water bottle or clothing or backpack or whatnot, students were expressing that they were feeling judged by that, right? And so this, I think, is no accident, because the corporate powers that be have very effectively talked about sustainability as an individualistic endeavor rather than a structural and collective, right, and political one. So students were sort of feeling that, well, you know, I'm maybe not seen as environmentalist, and environmentalists tend to be white and they tend to be well off, and environmental activities are almost always going outdoors and like hiking and rock climbing, et cetera. So very sort of narrow definitions of sustainability. So the sustainabilities element really emphasizes different cultural and social ways of being in relationship to place with more than human species and with each other. And when we talked about this idea of like critical sustainabilities, we broke it down to four different elements. And so the first is that we wanted to disrupt these normative narratives and epistemic hierarchies, right? So hierarchies of knowing, like whose expertise is centered, centering underrepresented voices, and unsettling dominant understandings by pluralizing this discussion. And we want to bring in like these important lived knowledges and different forms of knowledges. So that was the first part. And the second is that we wanted to elevate relationality and connection between people and place, with each other as humans, but also with non-humans, or what's been called sort of more than humans and the sort of socio-natures. And third, we wanted to confront, you know, we talk about this larger structural context. So what do we mean by that? We mean things like settler colonialism, white supremacy, both in higher education and the society at large. And then lastly, we wanted to center collective care, because our work as faculty at this institution, as administrators, as mentors and teachers, must address and support the whole student. So this idea of collective care, especially when we recognize that our students are grappling with a lot, you know, they talk to us about levels of eco-anxiety and eco-grief on top of other mental health struggles that they're having. And so it's not enough just to convey, you know, conceptual or disciplinary information to students, but how we care for them and how we get them activated to undertake the kinds of peer-to-peer, peer and faculty, you know, student and faculty, and campus and community partnerships that will be critical for us to address the kinds of environmental problems we face.
I would just add to that, that I think this book really tries to manifest this politics around critical sustainabilities, in the sense that we have really tried to bring in perspectives from across campus and from within the community as well. So while we're talking about critical campus sustainabilities, we're actively trying to do that as well in this book, in the sense that there are faculty who have contributed to the book, there are former undergraduates, there are graduate students, staff people, members of the community, just people who are differently positioned within the university and the community. And we're actively trying to bring forward their voices and show constructive ways that we can build connections across some of these lines of difference. The other thing that I would add too is that I think this idea of critical campus sustainabilities can also be manifested or represented by an event that took place previous to the pandemic and then through it, which was the graduate student strike that occurred. So in case your listeners don't know, UC Santa Cruz was the site of a wildcat strike by graduate students just before the pandemic in the fall of 2019. And then that was shut down during the pandemic and then later picked up again during their contract negotiations. And the graduate student strike was never solely about just labor issues per se. They incorporated a wide swath of other issues in there as well: housing, food insecurity, the rising cost of tuition, all kinds of other issues. And they made efforts to build relationships with other unions, with other social movements, to bring in a wide swath of social issues into their movement. And so that's part of the reason why in our conclusion, we begin by talking about the Wildcat Strike, because we feel like that kind of movement building is so essential to continue or to promote an idea of critical sustainability, that it's not just one very narrowly defined thing, but it's a very broad concept in which there's a lot of interest at stake in this.
Yeah, and I will say that was one of my favorite bits of the book, was making that connection to the labor action and showing how all these different issues are interconnected. I thought that was really, really important. So in dealing with all of these issues, you kind of look at them on several different levels. So I want to start with the pedagogical level, like in the classroom. How are these critical and anti-racist approaches incorporated into environmental studies?
Yeah, so I think that it's interesting. So my chapter, this is Emily, my chapter in particular is really focused on teaching and on pedagogy. And part of the way that I came to this chapter was really thinking about this question of anti-racist and critical pedagogies, and just thinking about teaching and learning in particular. And, you know, I'm a practitioner of teaching. I'm less so a researcher. And so I'm very interested in the application of research, like in the classroom. And what I came to observe is that sometimes these buzzwords around inclusive teaching or anti-racist teaching can become very flimsy, that people will just include more authors of color and then think that they are, you know, being inclusive, or they'll have a statement of inclusion and then they think they're being inclusive. And so it's these very small kinds of things that they think that they're doing, and then they get to use this label of inclusive or student-centered learning and teaching and things like that without really changing some of the key dynamics that are happening within the classroom between teacher and student, for instance, or the ways in which knowledge is transmitted and things like that. And so my chapter is really trying to search for or hone in on a concept that doesn't allow for this kind of very simplistic ways of enacting, you know, inclusion. And so I was sort of searching the literature for something that would kind of hit on what I was looking for. And I came upon this concept in the educational literature around relational pedagogies. And it does this deep dive into really centering relationality in the classroom as a key component of learning, and recognizing that the relationships that we build are themselves a source of information, right? This is a place of learning, the relationships. And so it's not just about content knowledge, or it's not just about a relationship with a teacher, but it's relationships with each other, instructor to student, you know, student to student, the student with the institution, the institutional networks that get embedded within it. And it goes even deeper into that in centering a relational ontology, right? So really understanding that the world is constructed out of relationships. And so it's this idea of a relational ontology and a centering of relationships. But I was like, yes, this is the concept that doesn't allow for, you know, it doesn't allow for, you know, kind of maybe what we might think of as more performative acts of inclusion, because, you know, inclusivity and relationality is so central to it. And so I think that's what it takes. And in addition to centering relationality, it's such a great concept for environmentalism as well, right? Because we do have an environmentalism that can be very narrowly focused on a very technical and scientific notion. And so if we want a truly radical, inclusive environmentalism, I think it really has to center on a completely different way of structuring and organizing our world, and very big changes in thinking. And so in my chapter, I'm really talking about the ways in which critical environmentalism and sustainability coincide so nicely with this concept of relational pedagogy in the classroom, so that both content as well as pedagogy kind of come together in ways that I think that don't happen often enough in higher education, that too often pedagogy is one thing and content is another, and the two never really talk to each other. But this concept helps to enact, you know, the very content, the ideas that we're trying to get across in the classroom. And so that's where I found it to be very powerful. So from my own perspective, is that critical and anti-racist approaches in the classroom really require a reimagining of what education is, you know, and how information gets taught, how skills get taught within classrooms and educational spaces.
Yeah, Flora, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I just really wanted to add that one of the hierarchies that exists in the institution is between Senate faculty and, you know, contingent faculty or lecturers. And I've worked closely with Emily through our mutual endeavors at the colleges, at College 9 in particular, and many other lecturers like Emily. And what I just been so struck by is that faculty like her are the ones who think so deeply and so expansively about pedagogy. And I just really wanted to uplift that, because I think as a professor of environmental studies, you know, I might have like sort of a narrow focus on my particular research area, but what I've learned about being a good teacher has come from being in community with folks. And so one of the things, as Emily mentioned, like what makes this critical is that we are not just sort of reifying and reinstituting, replicating these epistemic hierarchies, but what does it look like to really take pedagogy, for example, seriously?
Yeah, excellent. So then on another level that you talk about is the institutional level. So how the department is run, how the college or university is run. So how does critical sustainability come into play on that level?
Yeah, so I'm going to take you back to 2014. And that was an important year, I think, for the development of the People of Color Sustainability Collective, because there was a confluence of things happening. There was an incident that was part of our sort of origin story as POCSC, in which a student of color was publicly humiliated by a white student in the library because the student of color threw away something in the wrong receptacle. And so the student then went and talked to the Ethnic Resource Centers, which is very much a space that feels safe for our students of color. And the student shared that, you know, this white student sort of like accused them of not caring about the environment, that they felt really humiliated, and that they weren't sure that UCSC was for them. And to step back for a moment is that UC Santa Cruz is really seen as, you know, this, you know, that environmental sustainability is a key part of who we are. It's like, it's our institutional DNA. It's how we, it's part of our, you know, international reputation. So this notion of being accused of not caring about the environment, whereas, you know, the campus is situated in this gorgeous redwood forest with like ocean views and everything, you know, is just felt sort of jarring for the student. The other thing that was happening during that time is I had an undergraduate of mine, her name is Chesley Pack, and she wrote the first of what were multiple senior theses that I advised. And these were senior theses written by women of color undergraduates. right? And she was interested in like, well, what's happening on campus? Why is our department in environmental studies so predominantly white, right? And so if you look at our demographics at both the undergraduate and graduate level, environmental studies is, it's the whitest department in the division and much whiter than the overall campus. And our undergraduate student body is 2/3 people of color, right? So this is a pretty striking finding. And what Chesley was writing about after these interviews that she conducted were that, you know, when she would ask people, it's because, well, people of color just sort of didn't know about environmental concerns. They weren't concerned. They didn't grow up with these concerns, right? So there were like these very interesting and problematic attributions that were part of the ether on campus at that time, that environmentalism is predominantly sort of a white thing. And who are the environmentalists? They're white men, they're hippies, et cetera, tree huggers, et cetera, right? So that was, sort of an imaginary that still to this day, I think persists in certain spaces, but was very predominant back in 2014. And I remember talking to our executive vice chancellor at the time in a meeting in which she asked me to come in. And I think that she was just sort of puzzled. And she's like, well, why is this environmental movement, like, you know, what's going on with like the racial relationships here, right? And so there was all these things that were happening on campus in which our campuses, its own sort of reflection and governance as seen through the campus sustainability plan, that was something that happened every 4 years, just tended to focus on like, you know, the same sort of techno-managerial sustainability elements, right? They weren't really talking about issues of equity, et cetera. And what's happened since the establishment of the People of Color Sustainability Collective in 2015, I think is a really profound change. And how the in campus culture and the campus climate. So the original goal of POCSC was just to really uplift and center the ways in which diverse communities care about the environment, steward it, understand it, right? And moving beyond, you know, on the one hand, for example, for certain groups like, you know, I'm Asian American, Emily's Asian American, you know, there wasn't really a sense that Asian Americans, you know, had close relationships with the environment. I think that was really echoed with, you know, members of our Black community as well. Whereas our Indigenous folks and Native American students were seen in this really romanticized ecologically, what's been called the ecologically noble savage. And then for our Latinx and Latina students, it was like, well, they're, you know, they're out working in agriculture, they're working on the land, but not seen as experts of the land, right? And so there was these really interesting ways in which environmentalism was racialized and that wasn't being problematized. So as part of POCSC, we not only undertook longitudinal research that we'll talk about here in a little bit, but these various forms of social media campaigns, program building, having these events that started bringing BIPOC community activists, scholars. We organized a day-long conference around food justice, for example, and started giving workshops and teaching classes, not only to our students, but as part of a diversity certificate program for mostly staff, graduate students, and other faculty. So starting to expand the, you know, the imaginaries of what environmentalism looks like at the institution. And I think what I'll, you know, I'm being long-winded here, but I think the last thing that I'll say here is that UC Santa Cruz has just launched its a strategic plan that's been led by the chancellor, Cindy LaReeve. And that's gonna influence our next decade of how we confront these really critical issues. And so one facet of the strategic plan is climate resilience. And another is, you know, sort of student undergraduate education and transformative education. And the ways I think about the work that we've been doing with the People of Color Sustainability Collective is to say that these things are tied, right? That how our students, their ability to thrive in this institution has to do with how we address existential crises such as climate change. And what we, so one facet of this new strategic plan that I'm particularly proud of is in the ways that we actually center sort of indigenizing our climate response, understanding that this institution, as many, you know, universities across this country came to be as the result of dispossession and settler colonialism. that even though our demographics for our students are increasingly people of color that reflect the demographics of the state, we are still, in terms of our leadership and our hierarchy, predominantly white. And that the epistemologies that we use often come from very narrow, Western sort of very non-inclusive ways of thinking. And I'll just sort of put it at that.
I don't have anything to add. That was great.
Okay. All right. Well, then we can go on to my next question, which was about some of the community partnerships that you talk about in some of the chapters of the book. How do those come into the picture?
Yeah. So UC Santa Cruz is a Hispanic serving institution, and it's also an NAPZ, which is an Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander serving institution. But we are located in the Central Coast of California, and this is an area that is very important to not only the state, but to the nation in terms of its agricultural production. And many of our students, a third of our undergraduate students, identify as Latinx. So when the couple partnerships that we really highlight here are partnerships that were created through both the People of Color Sustainability Collective and then the work from the colleges, College 9 and John R. Lewis College, to support these campus community relationships to really think about environmental sustainability, centering food justice, as well as educational equity. So let me give you an example of that. In two of the chapters, we talk about the emergence of a wonderful community garden called Calabasas Community Garden. It's located in Watsonville, and it's at an elementary school. So in 2012, I started working with Calabasas through some of my community engaged teaching in a particular class that I taught on environmental justice at the time. But over the years, with support from the USDA and other funders, internal funding as well, we were able to deepen that connection so that now we, with the partners, the community, the families, and the staff and the principal of Calabasas Elementary, we have a 1-acre community-led garden there. And well, why is this important? Because oftentimes, like gardens at schools, I mean, that's a wonderful thing that's becoming more and more common. This is a space that is very much community run and community led, so that UCSC students and students from other schools like community colleges nearby will go there and will learn from the families, will learn from the parents, many of whom work in the berry industry in Watsonville, which is a very important industry. And what my colleague, Linnea Beckett, who's a scholar of education, she has a grant right now to look at how informal STEM education is happening in the garden. How food knowledges and agroecological wisdom is being transferred from parents to students. And so in these chapters, we focus on a couple of our undergraduates who are women of color, especially women who come from, whose families hail from Mexico, and how they were really retained as a result of being able to spend time in the garden. And we coined this concept of a critical sense of belonging. Right, that in this programming that we were doing with the community, community members become like professors in their own right, in a sense, and that they in many ways are able to engage with students and resonate with them in ways that uplift different forms of epistemological understandings about this space, about students and their own education, because we know when students don't see themselves in what they're learning at the institution, they tend to feel pretty alienated by it, right? And so one particular student of mine, I'm going to name her here, Michelle Hernandez. Michelle was an undergraduate. She wasn't really sure why she was at UCSC. She, like many other students in her group of friends, she was thinking about leaving the university. And she got to the garden and she writes about this a praxis of loving relations. So that when she was back in the garden, she would be with people who reminded her of her family members back in Mexico. And as she talked with them about their experiences, their journeys, and the ways in which they relate to the plants and other living things in the garden, and basically break bread and make food together, she realized that there was so much that the university could do to support these kinds of exchanges that were for her not only something that kept her at the university, but really propelled her as now a staff member at the colleges and someone who's about to embark on her graduate education. So I think, you know, as Emily was talking about, this relational pedagogy doesn't end at the classroom, right? What community relationships are able to give us is a way in which we can try to combat these forms of elitism, of white supremacy, of epistemic exclusion that persist in universities and really drive our students to feel unwelcome.
Yeah. Emily, did you want to add anything to that?
Not at the moment.
Okay. Great. So, you know, this is a really student-centered book. It's one of the things I think is really powerful about it. And several of the chapters like really dig into the views that students hold about sustainability issues. So can you talk a little bit about what you found about, you know, what the students are really thinking?
Absolutely. This is one of, I'm a nerd, and I really love the chapters. We have multiple chapters that are based in a longitudinal survey, and looking at the literature, there are entire journals that are dedicated to sustainability education in higher ed, right? But I don't see too many articles that are based on the rich data sets that we have. So we conducted 3 campus-wide surveys in 2016, 2019, and 2022 open to our entire undergraduate student body. And in total, over the 3 years, our numbers of respondents were over 8,000. So it's a pretty large data set. And what you'll also note is that the first survey happened before the 2016 election, right? And then encompassed the Trump administration and also encompassed the pandemic. And we're getting ready to have the next survey in 2025, because it's been sort of every 3 years. So there's multiple findings that I encourage listeners, if they're, to please check these chapters out, because the students are telling us a lot of important things. And I don't think that these messages are limited to just University of California, Santa Cruz. So one question that you're mentioning is like, well, what about this idea of what do they know about sustainability, or what do we learn about sustainability? And so I'll just highlight in chapter 4, we have a chapter entitled Student Understandings of Sustainability. So what we did is we presented students with 5 different definitions of sustainability, and they're not sort of like collectively exhaustive, but they tend to reflect some of the predominant understandings of sustainability. So the first is that sustainability is using natural resources wisely, right? And it's typically what you hear when people say, like, what's sustainable? It's, you know, this idea of resource use. The second is that sustainability is building green facilities and infrastructure. The third was that sustainability is challenging societal economic structures that overexploit the environment. So, you know, in other words, sort of a hyper-capitalist system. The next is that sustainability is promoting culturally diverse knowledges and relationships with the environment. And that finally, the fifth definition is that sustainability is working towards social, economic, and environmental equity. So if there's a gamut to the degree to which the definitions are equity-centered, culturally salient versus more sort of infrastructural and more utilitarian, right? So what happens that in 2016, we start asking students to rank these definitions, and it's pretty much what you would expect. What we found is that the predominant definition early in the research tended to be the using natural resources wisely. But as time moved on, those definitions changed, and there was increasing excitement or importance being placed on ones that were more structural. So challenging these economic structures that overexploit the environment, or focusing on more equity-centered approaches, those rose in importance as the infrastructural facilities-based definition declined in importance. And we also looked at these definitions by race, gender, first-generation status, and major. And I'm not going to go through all the findings right now, but some of the things that really were flagged for me is that things that you would expect, for example, that for students of color, the notion of supporting more culturally salient and diverse knowledges was more important than it were for our white students, for instance. But some of the factors that mattered the most was gender, for one, that the definitions between women and men, female and male undergraduates, was really distinct. Whereas for the men who responded, and this was pretty enduring across the different years, they tended to focus on utilitarian and infrastructural definitions. And in our last, in the 2022 survey, we were also able to include our gender non-binary students, which is so important. And where do they fall on the gamut, right? They tend to be they actually are very closely aligned in terms of their definitions to women. We saw some interesting disparities between environmental studies majors and non-environmental studies majors in prior surveys, but in the most recent survey, those differences tend to almost sort of disappear, right? That our students as a whole want sustainability to be more equity centered, more structurally focused, more culturally salient, right? So they're sending this clear message. What I'll just say about those sustainability understandings is that for these five definitions, how we analyzed it is that we gave the percentage of students who ranked each definition either as one or top one or top two, right? So in a perfect parity situation for the five definitions, it would be 40%, 40%, 40% all the way down, right? And if you look at how it breaks down, what you tend to see is that, you know, there might be some instances where we get around 50% or 30%, but they are, but it's not that far away from the 40% parity benchmark. And what I tell my colleagues, what we should take away is that there not only are understandings of sustainability dynamic and changing over time and also by identity, but also that there's a pluralism of definitions. So if, for example, I talk to my students about sustainability, but don't unpack what I mean, it's very likely that the students in the class will have very different understandings of it, or like or what they prioritize or how they interpret it is going to vary. So we need to be extremely clear about what we're talking about. Because if I'm coming at a utilitarian resource related view, and I have students who don't think of, the natural world as a source of resources for human use, but think of it in more, relational or concentristic ways, I'm going to be talking past them. I'm not going to be able to convey or capture their perspective. And so I think we need to be doing a better job of problematizing and unpacking and operationalizing what we mean by sustainability.
I would just add to what Flora mentioned about the sort of statistical representation of perspectives at UC Santa Cruz is that there's actually quite a few undergraduates who contributed to this volume. It might not be apparently obvious who was an undergraduate, but there is an entire chapter that's a roundtable of undergraduates or former undergraduates sharing their perspectives. And the two authors on that chapter are also former undergraduates at this institution and of the environmental studies department. And then there's a couple of other students who also share perspectives who are undergrads as well. So Michelle Hernandez, as Flora mentioned, Adriana Renteria was also a contributor, but to a different chapter, who I also believe was an undergraduate as well. And I think when you look in conjunction between these the statistical information and the information that we get out of these large surveys, in conjunction with these more personal perspectives that are being put forth, you just see this pattern of which students feel like they are not made to belong, that their perspectives are not being represented. Many of them come from more urban backgrounds, and they don't see that represented in the curriculum. They don't see themselves being represented among the faculty. And then they feel like there's many invisible ways in which they sort of are made to feel like they don't belong, and the person doesn't even recognize that they're doing it, right? So they'll have a faculty member talking about these vacations that they go on or this boat that they own or something. And This person is like, I'm struggling, my whole family and my community is struggling just to make ends meet, right? And so it's that kind of, I think, those voices that I think most resonate for me when I think about, you know, students' perspectives of sustainability and the challenges that they face. It's the very individual perspectives combined with what we hear in the survey data.
Right. It's students of color, low income students, you know, when they talk, when they try to talk about some of the ways in which they, you know, try to have more sustainable practices incorporated in their daily lives and being told that, well, these, it's just because you're poor, or being sort of scoffed at or being dismissed, right, within these spaces. And what I'll just add is that roundtable discussion, these were all BIPOC students in ENVS, and with they, you know, we use pseudonyms for them, but I'm teaching a course this quarter that is a senior seminar. And one of the exercises that I did was to have my students read that chapter and go through and actually encode it, do a qualitative analysis of it. And I had students come up to me afterwards and say that what they heard their peers talking about gave voice to what they were feeling, but didn't think that it was institutional. They thought it was something that was wrong with them, right? And it goes back to the earlier research by Chesley Pack that I was mentioning, in which there's this idea like, oh, well, you know, certain people from underrepresented or historically marginalized backgrounds, they don't know or they don't care, right? And these kinds of attributions or these kinds of interpretations are profoundly deleterious when we recognize that at a national level, and there's really great data on this from, there's a study from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, for example, in 2018 by Pearson et al, that shows that when you ask people like how they care about the environment or who values it most importantly, that people of color are the most express the most concern, more so than with white folks. And some of the people who are glorified as being environmentalists, namely white men, when you ask them about their concern about the environment, they represent some of the least concerned, you know, compared to, so there's what Pearson et al. Called the environmental belief paradox, that that even people of color, like they express high rates of environmental concern and action, but don't see, they misinterpret their own communities as being unconcerned. And they elevate predominant groups by race or by class as somehow being the most concerned, when empirically that's just not the case. So it's some really, really interesting results that we see replicated on our campus as well.
And I'll just add on top of that, that what I find very encouraging from the perspective that are represented here are both it's that they recognize that it is not about them, that it is, there is something about the institution, that there is something about the environmental movement that they are trying to push back against and really critique, and they themselves are making the connections between environmentalism and critical environmentalism and the kinds of critical university studies sort of themes that Flora was talking about earlier, that really kind of looking at and challenging the elitism of the university, the elitism of knowledge production, like what gets considered knowledge and who gets to do it. They themselves are recognizing that those kinds of mechanisms are part of the reason why there are no faculty of color in their departments, that their perspectives are not being represented. And by making those connections, they are pushing back against, you know, sort of dominant elements within environmentalism as well as within higher education. And that's just very encouraging for me to see and to hear in their voices.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in this book. Hopefully we've given listeners a good taste and gotten them excited to learn more. So as we're moving towards the end of our time here, I wanted to first give you each an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important as you were writing this book.
There's so, so many people. We have a very long acknowledgement section in the book. And so Emily sort of hinted at this, but for me, the inspiration behind the book and the thought partners were people in the colleges, people in the ethnic resource centers, our students, there's our community partners, like all these people who oftentimes are not recognized for their expertise. They often not, oftentimes, you know, because faculty tend to take up so much space, like tenure track faculty, But I want to give a special shout out to the co-founders of the People of Color Sustainability Collective, Alita Erickson, Rebecca Fernandez, Adriana Renteria, and Nancy Kim.
I also just want to acknowledge all of the contributing authors from whom I learned so much about their perspectives, their work, what's going on in their communities. It was very empowering and to work with them and to read their work and read it very closely. So I also just want to give props to Flora for being the driving force behind this book. She was the true visionary who developed the initial proposal and had these amazing ideas and was brought everybody together, organized everybody to push this book through and to make it happen. So it was a multi-year endeavor. Flora was conceptualizing the book well before the pandemic, and it took through the pandemic and afterwards to finally get it to fruition. But she was very much the brains and the vision behind this. And so I props to Flora for being the driving force behind this.
All right. And our listeners can't see the smile on Flora's face right now on Zoom. But that brings us to the last question that we always ask here on the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on next?
Mm-hmm. If I can go first, what I've realized through this experience and with working with the People of Color Sustainability Collective, but then also just closely with my students through the colleges when I was provost, is that some of my best ideas come from my students. So I had a student who she's ethnically Chinese, but she was adopted by a white family. And we were talking about this idea of like, well, you know, this category of Asian or Asian American, and like, it allied so much heterogeneity. And so how can we start like unpacking that? So we did some focus groups with our Filipino students, with our Indian American students, Chinese American students. And so I'm interested, and this will be a multi-year project, but thinking about the ways, and especially in which Asians and Asian Americans have contributed to environmentalism here in this country and to sustainability thinking. And for the most part, I think I've just been really surprised by how little emphasis there's been about that. So I want to work on that. And then more practically, last night when I was in class in my senior seminar with students, we've been working on these projects, and I had these two wonderful students who, when we were discussing the roundtable chapter in the book, and then reading some of the other chapters, what students were telling me is that they felt that for some of the faculty in environmental studies in particular, but more broadly, that there was a lot of performativity happening around sustainability. And we're like, oh, what does that mean? Like, what is performativity? Well, how do you know? And what is that about? So we've been sort of diagramming some ideas, and I don't know if it's going to turn into a paper specifically, but I'm very interested in this space, you know, kind of going back to this idea of collectivity and what it means to like engage with each other with honesty and with care. Like, what does, you know, how do students see performativity by faculty, and especially perhaps by some of our white faculty or white male faculty, and right, how is it landing on them? So that's been really, I've been really chewing on that recently.
I'm currently working on a project that at first glance may seem really different, but I actually do see it kind of tied into this. I'm doing a small research project on non-tenure track faculty in geography. I'm working with Dr. Ken Foote at the University of Connecticut on this, and he's done a lot of work on professional development within the discipline of geography. And we've collected all of our data. We're in the writing stages right now, but I'm hoping to grow this project to provide additional support services, resources to non-tenure track faculty in geography who have very limited access to institutional resources, very constrained on time, and figuring out the best ways to support them in the positions that they are in. And I will just say that I do this mostly out of support or out of a desire to support teaching and learning in higher education. I believe so profoundly in this, in the mission of teaching undergraduates that I'm not by nature like a labor person per se, but it's because of the issues they brought up. Volume. It's in service of really wanting to promote stronger teaching and learning that I undertake this project, because I do believe that working conditions are other students' learning conditions. And so I'm hoping to support kind of environmental education in a different capacity.
All right, well, that all sounds really exciting. I'll definitely be, you know, keeping an eye on both of you and seeing the results of some of that as it comes out in the future. So thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Stentor. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. We enjoyed this.
This has been a conversation with Flora Liu and Emily Marai, editors of Critical Campus Sustainabilities, Bridging Social Justice and the Environment in Higher Education, published in 2023 by Springer.